Support for WPR comes from the Door County Maritime Museum, where Great Lakes maritime history comes alive. One history, three ports of call. Sturgeon Bay, Cana Island Lighthouse, and Death's Door. DCMM.org.
And I think finally is what Shakespeare is, a heightened expression of life. When I played him, I was 27, I think, much too young, but it was a big success. And what Henry Hughes said, he looks like has a profile of a dog, a fox terrier or somebody, and he's too young, but in the jealousy scenes, he's the greatest Othello some of us have ever seen. And I'm deeply grateful, I think, that today when I pass on, I know that the Arden edition of Shakespeare will go on as it's gone on, and in the Arden edition of Othello, Mr. Robeson, Paul Robeson and myself are the only two black actors mentioned as being of, shall we say, merit. And it's thrilling, you know, it's good to know.
Earl Hyman is best known for his role on the animated TV series Thundercats as the voice of the character Panthro and various other characters. He also appeared on The Cosby Show as Cliff's father, Russell Huxtable. But Earl Hyman was also a dynamic film and stage actor, one with an unlikely career trajectory. His genesis as an actor was as dramatic as some of the parts he played. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Barrett Kelly, professor of theater and drama at the UW-Madison. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I have to ask first, Barrett, I mean, this is an actor that many of us will not be familiar with, even if, you know, we have heard of, say, The Cosby Show, but it's in the past now, and so many of us have not even seen that. There is, as we've implied, quite a background behind all of the TV, though, that goes way back before that, which is some really distinguished things. Where did your interest in Earl Hyman start?
Well, I first met Earl when I was a student at the High School of Performing Arts in New York City. One of the great things about PA, as we called it, was they would have guests that would come in and do master classes for the acting students, or give talks. And Earl was one of those people, and some other acting teacher greats who a lot of actors would know who these names are, Uta Hagen, Sanford Meisner and such. But Earl came in, I was about 15, 16 years old, and we were given a little introduction to who Earl was. And I became fascinated by this man's career, let alone his Shakespearean trajectory. And I was 15, 16 years old at the time, like I said, but I was fascinated by his Scandinavian career. And that's what really endeared me to this man. And much later, when I was thinking about doing a PhD, I thought, you know what? Let me see if I could write the seminal work on Earl Hyman's Scandinavian career. And that's where it started.
Earl Hyman died in 2017, so plenty of other actors have benefited from his teaching.
Oh, yeah.
But first of all, what kind of personality does he have? Because when we say an actor's personality, you're talking about a chameleon often.
James Earl Jones, who some people in the audience will know who James Earl Jones is, has gone on record by stating that he would have no career if it wasn't for Earl Hyman and the folks that came before Earl Hyman, the particular African-American actors at that time. So Earl was a particular product of his time, but he also had a dream to do certain kinds of work, which at that time African-American actors by and large, weren't getting the opportunities to do. So Earl had a dream of becoming a classical actor, even though he had gotten tremendous opportunities early on when he was 17 or so in radio, and then he eventually got into some Broadway shows and such like that. And then he was working with the American Negro Theater, which took a show to Broadway called Anna Lucasta. But Earl still had a dream of being a major classical actor.
And what were his opportunities then as an African American?
Well, what happened, the role models that when Earl was a young man, and we're talking about 1940s and such, Paul Robeson, who became famous for his production of Othello in 1944-45 during the war, and besides his activism, which a lot of people knew about, his civil rights activism, even though he was labeled a communist by the United States government, which that wasn't true. And another actor by the name of Canada Lee, who was tremendous. And Canada Lee had done Shakespeare's The Tempest on Broadway, which Margaret Webster directed. And also the audience, some old movie buffs would remember Canada Lee playing the stevedore Joe in Alfred Hitchcock's movie Lifeboat with Tallulah Bankhead. And there's a section where he reads the 23rd Psalm, which still holds up to today, which is excellent. And so these were the people that Earl Hyman was looking at as far as African-American actors. But there were other actors that he was just looking at, that he was, you know, watching their work. And he wanted to be like them. That's all he wanted to do. Evola Galleon and Catherine Cornell and others who had these major repertory companies at the time. And but he stayed true to his dream. And it's, I know we'll get into the Scandinavian thing, and most people out there are probably going, well, how did this happen with him going? Well, in the long and the short of it, Earl Hyman was born in 1926. So when he was 13 years old in 1939, and some in the radio listening audience will know that 1939 was the golden year of Hollywood. Wizard of Oz, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Gunga Din, all of these great movies. And his mother had the newspaper out on the kitchen table, and he's a 13-year-old. And she said, what do you want for your birthday? And so he saw all of these titles, The Wizard of Oz and all that. So his mother thought he was going to say The Wizard of Oz. And he saw something, a title of something called Ghosts, which is an Ibsen play.
Sure.
And he didn't know that. He wanted to, he said, oh, I want to go see Ghosts. He's 13 years old.
Go to Norway.
So Alan Nazimova, a wonderful actress, was on her last leg of her tour of touring Ibsen's Ghosts at one of the old theaters out in Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, and he paid his 50 cents or whatever it was and went up in the balcony and saw this production. And even though he was too young to sort of understand the themes of this, but by osmosis, even though they were, the dialogue was in English, the drama wafted over him, and he said, you know what, I want to learn how to read Ibsen in the original language. And that started him on his lifelong quest to learn Norwegian.
Which in 1939 sounds even more unlikely, doesn't it? I
mean, that's correct.
It's hard enough being an African-American actor in America, but yeah, going to Norway and acting to Norwegians in their language?
Well, you know, what Earl did was he met some actors and people in the Norwegian theater community in New York, and he took classes, City College and such, and he got a letter of invitation, and this is much later, 1956-57, he got a letter of invitation to some of the theater luminaries in Norway. And he went over, and the rest is history. By then, Earl could speak fluent Norwegian in both dialects, Bokmål and Nynorsk, New Norwegian. Bokmål is the more rural regional dialect. And then during one of his interviews, Bjarne Andersen, who is the artistic director of Den National Scene, the national stage in Bergen, heard him and contacted him to see if he would be interested in playing Othello in Norwegian. This is pre-John F. Kennedy being assassinated in the United States in 63, so 61, 62. And Earl hesitated at first, but then there's a funny story about that. I don't know if you have time. John Lithgow, a lot of people will know who John Lithgow is. John Lithgow's father, Arthur Lithgow, was the artistic director of a Shakespeare company in Ohio. And he had hired Earl to play Othello. Earl had come back to the United States, and so Arthur Lithgow hired Earl to play Othello. And it was Lawrence Luckinbill who was playing Iago. And during the performance, this is all true, during the performance, Earl transposed some of the Shakespearean dialogue into Norwegian, maybe if it was a sentence or two. And Lawrence Luckinbill's eyes widened.
Where'd that come from?
Where'd that come from? And so then I guess Earl figured, well, maybe I should do this. And then he contacted Bjarne Andersen and took a chance, and the rest is history.
Okay, Othello is one thing, you know, part for a black actor.
Yes, right.
There's a whole lot of Shakespeare other than that, though. And how does Earl Hyman break into that?
Well, what happened Earl was the first African-American actor in the American Shakespeare Festival in Stamford, Connecticut. And John Houseman, the late John Houseman, was one of the artistic directors. And Earl had started to make a name for himself doing little off-Broadway shows and such. And he came in to the audition, and Houseman asked him, why do you want to be in the American Shakespeare Festival? And Earl basically said, well, it's called the American Shakespeare Festival, isn't it? And so I guess that was good enough for them, and, you know, he was a good enough actor. And he opened the festival with Julius Caesar. He played the soothsayer in Julius Caesar. You know, that's the character that does the Ides of March speech and all of that. And so that's where it began. And so he had a series of roles over, you know, five, six seasons of doing at the American Shakespeare Festival. He actually performed with Katharine Hepburn, who some of the audience will remember. Katharine Hepburn played Cleopatra, and there was another wonderful actor who a lot of people may remember named Robert Ryan.
Sure.
And Robert Ryan played Antony, and Earl Hyman played Alexis in that. So, you know, Earl had a pretty good run of roles, you know, in those seasons. And then when he went to Norway, he did a Norwegian play called Jalla Brui, which translates to the bridge across. And he had done, what else did he do? He did some Fugard. He also played another role that was written by a black man, but it's the first time in Norway, when the Emperor Jones, or the Kaiser Jones, and such. And then, you know, so Earl became, in Norway, Bestefar Cosby Show, Grandfather Cosby Show. He became a great son of Norway and was awarded the National Medal, or the Gold Medal, and all of this. He became a fixture. I have to just tell the audience that when I was in Norway, and that was my first Fulbright, and we were marched out in front of the board. It was a big banquet and dinner, and all the scientists and everybody were up on the stage. And so they, one by one, everybody had to get up and say what they were doing on the Fulbrights. So, you know, some scientists or whatever talked about solar energy. Then it came my turn. So I had my little spiel in Norwegian, because I had learned Norwegian here. And I said, jeg skriver om Earl Hyman, amerikanske skuespilleren. And the audience erupted. And everybody on stage, all the Americans were going, what are you doing? They know what you're doing. And, you know, most of the age of that generation of people, you know, 20 years ago, they still remembered Earl on the stage when they were coming up as, you know, folks, you know. And so it was wonderful to go over there and meet all the people that Earl had acted with and that were very important to him in his life, including the daughter of his of Earl's famous stage partner, Anna Gulestad, who's passed away, of course. So it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Sort of, at least from a broadcasting standpoint, I suppose, yeah. Problem for stage actors is that so much is ephemeral. It's just lost. We have no record whatever of so many great stage performances. Is that true also of Earl Hyman?
In Norway, part of my research was going to the national, the NPR, called the NRK of Norway, which is situated in Oslo, and I would go in and listen to those tapes of Earl doing Othello, certainly, and because that was a big deal. There was a certain flight that left from Oslo to Bergen just so people could go up there and see that show. So that's not a long flight at all, maybe 40 minutes of that. And so to hear Earl and Per Theodor Haugen, who played his Iago, and I met Per when I was there and we talked about this, but just hearing the enunciation and the way that, you know, it was sort of large, but the Norwegians call it stort vokal, this voice that has presence to fill a space. And so Earl, you know, it gave me a sense of him as an actor. If I can do a little imitation, let me see if I could do this.
Hva heter du? Ja, så Iago.
That's the best that I could do right now. What say, that was part of the temptation scene, in the beginning of the temptation scene, when Iago's trying to get Othello to believe that Desdemona is being unfaithful to him and all that. And he says, what say you, Iago? What? And blah, 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 blah. So anyway, yeah.
Was Norway kind of an episode in Earl Hyman's life then?
Well, eventually what happened, he met his partner there, Rolf Sierenes, and he and Rolf were together for 20 years. I mean, eventually Earl did buy a place there, but then Earl was always floating between Norway and coming back to the States to do things. So he was, you know, well accepted there. He did not have a chance to actually perform at the National Theater of Norway doing an Ibsen play. And I asked a lot of people, you know, that knew Earl, and, you know, so that would, I was over there right after 9/11 for the first time. So I said, why didn't Earl get a chance to do this? And all they could tell me was it wasn't time. Earl never admitted that to me, but it wasn't time. But that's another discussion about immigration and all the stuff that's been happening overseas, as people know and been reading in the papers. But he was a tremendous actor. But when he came back to the U.S., of course, he did everything, you know. But he was a great son of Norway, Earl.
And we'll hear about Earl Hyman returning to the U.S. and what kind of roles he had, and how he has also left his mark on actors to follow him when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
In Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, I played Othello many, many times. And it was really exciting playing it in a different language, although when I played it, I didn't feel it was all that different. Because you have to, this is the way this man speaks. And in Othello, he's an outsider from the get-go, so that playing him in Norwegian didn't seem that far off. It felt just as natural to do one as it is the other. After a while, then it got too natural, and in a tour in Denmark, I realized one night I had to stop it. I was becoming an actor who did Othello in Norwegian. And I would, while doing it in Norwegian, I could be thinking other things in other languages, such as French or English.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Baron Kelly, and we're finding out about the actor Earl Hyman, African-American actor born in 1926 in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and yet somehow ends up in Norway acting Shakespeare in Norwegian, and along the way, and after that, also quite a distinguished career for Earl Hyman. But I have to wonder, Baron, so what's the connection? I gather he goes to New York from Rocky Mount at an early age?
Yeah, his parents moved them up to, he and his siblings up to New York. Earl must have been, you know, 6-7 years old, but they always went back for summer vacations to North Carolina. As a matter of fact, my father used to take us down to Jacksonville, Florida, actually, and during the summer, so we could see our cousins and all of that. So on one of Earl's trips, so we're talking in the mid-30s, and I guess he just goes into a library and says, what's the biggest book you have?
Well, it is money's worth, so to speak.
I could imagine the librarian's eyes going, so he said, take the Shakespearean book over there or whatever, go and look for Shakespeare. And so that's, you know, if that's true or not, at least that's what Earl said. But and he took it home and just started reading these plays and became attracted to the language. He was always attracted to language and plays.
I was going to say, because Shakespeare would be kind of a tough place to start, even if you had been reading, you know, some of the more common elementary school literature.
But, you know, you could imagine if he wanted to learn Norwegian, I mean, that's tough enough for adults. I mean, God knows. But he was always determined. As a matter of fact, the other African-American actors that he was meeting and working with, because he'd carry Shakespeare around with him, and they said, what are you doing? And he was hoping to get cast. I said, nobody's going to cast you in that. Wake up. Nobody's going to cast you in that, basically. But he stayed to his dream, you know.
Oh, did he have bit parts in films?
No. The odd one early on in his career was the Ray Milland Lost Weekend movie with Billy Wilder, that Billy Wilder directed. And there was a notice on the call board that they were looking for actors for this movie shooting in New York with Ray Milland, and Earl loved movies. And so went down, and I guess Billy Wilder had just seen him in Anna Lucasta and Broadway. He said, wait a minute, this is just extra work, or, you know. He said, it doesn't matter, I want to do it. So I got a DVD of Lost Weekend, and I slowly, I know the scene that Earl's in when Milland is like walking around and he's looking for a bottle and stuff. And so, you see a snippet of Earl Hyman, and then Earl did television in Norway. I mean, in this country, right? Of course, television did in 1949.
Yeah, so it really started to take off, yeah.
Earl did plays and such. He did radio dramas. But his most of his stuff was in the theater. Another side note, he did play Hamlet, and John Gielgud coached him in Washington, D.C., because Owen Dodson, the great Owen Dodson, was on the faculty at Howard, and he directed a production with African-American actors, and he knew Earl, so he said, well, do you want to play Hamlet? And Earl had met Gielgud, and so Gielgud actually coached him for the role of Hamlet. Earl has talked about that. And Earl had worked in London. Earl replaced Sidney Poitier when Poitier had done A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway. And when they did the London company, Earl played the Walter Lee role that a lot of people don't know this, that Sidney Poitier made famous in the New York production.
And that helped to make Sidney Poitier famous.
You better believe it. You better believe it.
In terms of, let's say, creative casting, there had been some of that. I suppose there probably always was in the theater that we just may not be aware of, casting a character of one race into
always
a part of another. Yeah.
You know, I just taught two classes in London, a cultural studies course called Race, Shakespeare, and Globalization. And the way that these characters were portrayed in the media, that when I mean the media, paintings, you know, with these particular roles, one of the role models that Earl Hyman had was an actor by the name of Canada Lee, the actor that was in Lifeboat. And he played, for greater or worse, Caliban in The Tempest on Broadway. He played, you know, the monster.
Today,
that's just not played by an actor of color, depending on what the concept is. Could be anyone. And then Earl saw Canada Lee do a play, The Duchess of Malfi, and Canada Lee played Bosola. And there's a famous picture of Canada Lee. He had used special makeup to put on his face, this pinkish white makeup, but he had these black gloves on, because isn't that amazing? Because they wouldn't let, well, people wouldn't have been comfortable with a black man playing that role opposite Elizabeth Bergner.
Of course.
And so, but anyway, Earl was just influenced by all of that. And certainly he got a chance to certainly fly in a few of the other roles that he did at the Shakespeare Festival. But I think he found in Norway that there was a particular acceptance for his talent. And he was welcomed with open arms by the folks there. And so, you know, he felt a sense of, I guess, similar to how some black folk maybe felt going to Russia in the 1920s and 30s because of all the stuff that they were dealing with in this country, even though it was a different context with Earl, but just a different, they'd never seen anything like him. He was well over 6'2", tall, distinguished looking man who spoke fluent Norwegian. They'd never seen, most people, and including some of you listening to this, most people think everybody in Norway is blonde-haired and blue-eyed. That's not the case.
Well, there are, these days, I can tell you, some Somali Norwegians.
Exactly, and that's right. And, you know, you have people from Pakistan, Vietnam, the Philippines. For whatever reason, they immigrated to Norway and Sweden and Denmark. Sweden was the first to open the floodgates. But so there's a whole history of acceptance of particular folks trying to have a better life and trying to make do with themselves in Norway. Still not easy, but, you know, just I could just imagine what he felt like in the 1960s. And of course, John F. Kennedy's promise, and then Lyndon Johnson's promise in this country, and he's reading about
the Great Society.
The Great Society and all that.
Well, there is, yes, a long history in continental Europe. It goes way back. You can read about various composers, like one of the Chevalier de Saint-Georges in France.
France
certainly had a strong tradition of accepting other nationalities, including Africans.
That's correct.
And so the Norwegians wouldn't surprise me. The Norwegians and the Swedes in particular always seem to have been, what shall we say, experimental in many ways. Social, or if you wish to call it a, you know, avant-garde, but a long tradition of that.
It's true.
Did Earl Hyman have any kind of a preference for one medium over the other? They're so different in some ways. There's theater. I remember London Fontaine saying of their brief movie experience, "We can be bought, we cannot be bored," when it came to actually making a film, let alone television. And I don't think they ever did TV except for maybe the Dick Cavett show. Did Earl Hyman express any kind of preference for one medium over another?
No, I think later in his career, certainly with the success of The Cosby Show, I mean, you know, the money was just plentiful. But most actors, if they have a chance, I'm reading Patrick Stewart's memoir right now, among others. And you listen to particular actors that came up in the 50s and the 60s. The theater is really the testing ground for the craft, because you have to be able to sustain a performance for at least 2 hours from beginning to end.
Live
live.
Off book.
That's right. Whereas film and certain television, it's a director's medium. So you can cut, you know, you can edit, you can go back and do that. Just like...
retake.
That's right. Like in the, but that's why it was so nerve-wracking in the live days of, in the days of live television, early television, because they had to fly by the seat of their pants sometimes, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yes.
It was great. It was great training. It's easier for a stage-trained actor to do, for the camera, to be able to calibrate the performance for the camera than it is for a filmic actor to then calibrate the performance for a large house because of the way you have to project and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think probably for a lot of us who are so accustomed to the relatively intimate medium of television and the way you can mic it.
That's right.
It would be true of radio too, to a lesser extent. But there is this moment when you're attending a stage play that you really have to make a little bit of an effort to suspend your disbelief.
Well, you know, I talk about this with students. The beautiful thing about the theater is, as most folk who've been to APT and have seen the productions there with, and even going back into the day with the great Randy Kim, Randall Duke Kim, and his wife Annie Ocho Grosso, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the way particular audiences have been trained to see a performative act on the stage. When the lights go down, there's an unspoken convention that we agree to the willing suspension of disbelief. When you see Hamlet, you know that Hamlet is not dead at the end of the play. The actor, you know.
We hope not.
We hope not. Well, although there have been mishaps in productions on stage.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, yeah. But it's the agreement that we're watching an event live in front of us, you know.
And it's still, unlike some other media, again, television and film to some extent, the theater does require some imagination on the part of the viewer,
yeah,
as to, oh, this really is a room in a castle, or, you know, this really is, any number of actions taking place which are muted in the practicalities of the stage.
And why do people go to opera? You know, there are heightened emotions. People get involved in the spectacle. Now, there are different, as you well know, and I'm sure your audience knows, there are different genres of plays. But you still, the great Ingmar Bergman, who's a great Swedish director, film and theater, somebody asked him years ago in an interview, you do theater, but why do you go back to film? Or it was the other way around, pardon me. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, theater is a faithful wife where film is an elusive mistress. So
clearly he'd been giving it some thought.
Yeah! He went back to, he was going back to his wife. But today, everybody watches reality television and all this other stuff, and they say, oh, I want to be an actor. But they don't realize that there's craft involved. There are wonderful actors out there that are just taking the money, doing projects that are not taxing them. But if you see really good actors, and everybody has their own choice from, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio, Denzel Washington, you name it, Christian Bale, and a slew of others. I'm just mentioning these male actors. That's craft there. That's craft. You just can't just stand up and start doing that. You have to train for that. Just
well, and I did read somewhere recently an actor or a director is saying, you want to be a film actor, start in the theater. Start in the theater. And it must be a different vibe for the actor, too, because in film and television, almost always, I think these days, there's really no audience there when you're doing your acting.
And it's all imaginary, and how one trains oneself to defictionalize the fiction and involve yourself in the storytelling, whether the storytelling is for the camera, to calibrate the performance for the camera, or whether you're going to be on the stage telling the story with your body and your actions achieving an objective. When I was starting out, and I would sit in the rehearsal hall and watch these great directors that I worked with watch these stars, titans of the theater. I was interested in how these people interacted in and out of character.
How Fascinating, isn't it?
How did they agree? How did they disagree? How did they collaborate? That was just as great of, oh, how did that person do that? Or I want to do that. To see how they behaved and how they, what their comportments were. You know, so that...
Are some actors always on?
I guess, you know. Well, I have friends in California, lovely people, but they love to be in front of the camera. That's just them. And then there are some actors, and I've worked with Pacino, who once whatever the business is over with, he disappears. De Niro's like that as well. And some people, different strokes for different folks. I mean, you know, I think if you care about the craft, if Anthony Hopkins, for instance, of course, I'd never met Mr. Hopkins, but when he was doing the movie Silence of the Lambs, let's say, and he was playing Hannibal Lecter.
Very intense.
There are stories that he could be joking with the crew, you know, and then the director said, Tony, we're going to do a take. And he'd like
just
flip the switch and go right back into that. Styling.
Almost scary, isn't it?
It's craft. It's craft. Instead of the actor saying, okay, I'm going to play myself now. That's all. Some do.
Well, again, as far as film and television in particular, we don't have this problem too much in radio, but yes, radio acting would be the same if you didn't have the audience there, especially if you're doing comedy. You don't have anybody reacting. You don't know if they're getting it or not.
So then what do you have to do as the actor for that in radio? You have to have
hope maybe, although I don't suppose it would be that, I don't suppose it would be all that professional. You have to maybe kind of go on the affect of your fellow actors.
There you go. You have to, there's a term in acting that's called the reciprocal exchange of emotion or whatever. You're being affected by what's across from you or around you in some sort of way, or you have to place yourself in that environment and how that environment feeds on you. Do you know what I mean? So
sure.
That you don't sit there and, okay, what do I do now? What do I do? How do I do this? No, you just let it happen.
Well, in front of a live audience too, though, I think any kind of genre, really, I was going to say comedy in particular, it has to affect your timing, though, because you get a big laugh, you can't start your next line until they can hear you.
That's right. You know, I just directed a play in Idaho, and the actors, they'd never really watched Laurel and Hardy.
Wow.
You know, once I showed them pictures, they said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then I had one of the actors do a physicality that Oliver Hardy would do, or Stan Laurel, depending on the context. And I had him do it. And I said, when you're doing this, just do this with your foot. Do this with your leg. And I showed him what I wanted. And when they performed in front of the audience laughed. He said, so some of the people in the audience got this, you know? I said, yeah, you know. So I try to bring a little bit of that into things, you know, and to see if audiences will just pick up on certain kinds of physicalities and such like that. Not everybody, but pardon me, some will.
More about Earl Hyman acting and Baron Kelly when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Oh, yes, I remember. That's how it is. And we weren't in Elizabeth Eaton. But so many things are still going on here. You can find them. I find them especially with things of nature, flowers, scents, taste, all the important things, the senses. He knew them to such a degree of exactitude, of also feeling it. You know, it's just... Like a rose, you can say all you want, and it was Shakespeare who gives you the rose in its scent, shape, color, extraordinary. And he didn't want you to buy the book either. He just wanted you to come to the theater and buy a ticket.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Baron Kelly, who is telling us about Earl Hyman, great African-American actor of theater, and TV and film, and we're getting into the whole concept of acting in general, some of the psychology for the actor. And well, I guess as long as we've mentioned radio, Baron, in terms of contrasting it with the experience for the actor, whether in theater or film or television, radio is something where you just have to rely upon your instrument, as they say, isn't it?
It certainly is. And when I started doing radio spots in New York, commercials or cartoon voices in New York, working with some of the great directors, what a great training that was for me. Yes, I understood about how to use the voice in the theater and all that, but then to take it down and have nuance in the writing. And certainly here with Chapter a Day, which I've been very fortunate and blessed to have read a couple of books, and working with Michelle Good, who has taught me a lot about pacing and tempo, particularly if you have to read X amount of pages in X amount of time, which is not easy, and still keep the through line of the story going. So that's what's really important. And I'm very text-based anyway in the theater, I mean, with scripts and such. I mean, that's the way I was trained in London, of looking at the text in a particular way and marking it up the same way that a conductor will mark up a score for the orchestra, for pacing, tempo, inflection, and all of that, which a lot of actors, they don't do that, but I do that. And so when I'm directing something, I help guide the actors that way. And the ones that I've trained in these training programs, it's benefited them, you know, tenfold. So,
but you can't use gesture. You can't even use facial expression when you're doing just audio.
That's right. It's the voice. It's the voice. And there are some wonderful actors that we know, that we've seen in movies and television, and maybe they would be boring on radio because they're used to doing things in a sort of...
I've heard that.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
I saw me in what we would call classical radio plays. It's fascinating how much difference there is between actors who are reading a script, which is, of course, what you get to do in radio, although the farther away you are from the script, the better off you are as an actor. But, of course, they were busy people in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and they might come in just to, in effect, almost read a part, and then half an hour later they're on a cab going back across New York. But they have a great deal of variety, those actors. One of the better ones I remember is Spencer Tracy, actually, a good Wisconsinite from Milwaukee, who you really couldn't tell. He was acting against Betty Davis, I think, and now Voyager for radio. And he was great, but some of them on shows like the Academy Award Theater, for example, which were, you know, kind of re-boiled down radio versions of Academy Award winning films, flat readings, you know, just, it's just surprising.
That's a good way to, flat readings.
Yeah, major actors, and it's like,
well, they used to, they used to say that watching Gary Cooper shoot a film, and people would say, well, what is he doing? I can't. And then when they would see the rushes, they would go like, oh, we get it. You know what I mean?
The outtakes and retakes.
You know, and then the listening audience is probably not aware that Mr. Norman Gilliland and I did a radio play called Necessary Sacrifices. Well, we turned a stage script into radio drama.
Which worked, yeah, very well for audio, actually, because it was a dialogue between Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and there weren't a lot of, like,
great
actions going on.
That's right.
It was mostly the intense, rather intense at times, dialogue between the two of them. And, of course, it was a matter of getting into the character as much as possible.
Getting into the character as much as possible.
And the arc of their relationship as it developed. Speaking of developing, getting back to Earl Hyman, his legacy entering into the bloodstream of you and other actors today?
Yeah, sure. Well, whenever I get ready to do something important, there are two actors that I think about in my consciousness, and that's Earl Hyman and Randall Duke Kim, without question. I stand on the shoulders of those great men that have come before me. So if I can move or spur consciousness, particularly with younger actors or somebody watching the performance, then that's great. I mean, I remember here I did A Doll's House at the university. This is 20 years ago. And during the talk back, somebody raised their hand and the director was in the audience and said, "Did you cast Baron because he was black actor?" Because I played Krugstad, who was the villain of the piece. And Barbara Clayton, the director, said, no, I cast him because he was the best actor that I wanted for that. So anybody can say whatever and look at things and, you know, and have their own biases and opinions. You know, you still have to play the role. You still have to enter into the role the same way that anybody else who may be blonde-haired and blue-eyed has to enter into the role. How somebody takes that is a completely different story. And I've always had the argument about opera. I've always had the argument about where would these great actors like James Earl Jones and Gloria Foster and all of them have been if they would have worried about, well, no one's going to cast me in that role. Raul Julia, by the way, or Julia. People remember him from Gomez from the Addams Family, but he was a wonderful actor. Yeah, so, you know, you do the best that you can. And that lineage hopefully will keep going on. As far as I'm concerned, it will.
Does it seem to be opening up, though, in terms of, let's say, well, industry, audience acceptance of actors playing roles counter to what you'd expect for race? I remember I saw right at the university, well, it wasn't university theater, I think it was, but it was a production in Wisconsin of Constanza Mozart as a African-American woman. I mean, it worked fine. I had, frankly, not given it a lot of thought, but it worked fine.
Well, I mean, I don't think there have been a lot of people that even complained in opera when Leontine Price and, you know, Shirley Verrett and Grace Bunbury and all these people were on the stage doing things. You know, you might have had a couple of people, some people in the South, that, but for, by and large, these great artists. Great artists, you know?
And it's up to, I guess, to the artist to carry the illusion. And
correct.
If it's a great artist, you're not really noticing some of those details.
That's
so it's, much as what does that person sound like and does that person convince me? And then you don't even think about that. If they're really good, you are
today
into
we
it.
Have shows on television like Shonda Rhimes's Bridgerton. So you have a multicultural cast. There's nothing wrong with that. Except that there have to be all of the other stories that are told to balance that out so that you don't get a skewed version of history.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it does seem that we have in the last, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 years or so, sort of gotten over the hump in terms of this is a black actor, so he will play the part of a black person.
That's
it can't be just a black actor who's playing a detective who happens to be black.
That is correct.
Nothing is ever said about race.
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. And I think more and more people are in that sort of now with what's happening on cable and, you know, and all these platforms, you're seeing more and more of that. But we can't forget the people, the pioneers that came before, that laid down a lot of pavement for those of us coming behind to, you know, get on that road.
Yeah. Any place where we can actually see Earl Hyman other than reruns of The Cosby Show?
No, I think if people just do a search on IMDb, you know, the odd show that he may have done in the 80s or such.
Right. If you go to IMDb, it'll give you a list of his performances.
Yeah, but pretty much the Cosby Show, that was what he was well known for to a generation of people who didn't even know about his Broadway credits. I mean, you know, so.
That seems to happen fairly often. It's like somebody who has a fairly light role in mass media, and you have, I have no idea that person was so diverse and powerful in so many more demanding roles.
That's exactly true. I mean, what was it, 14 years ago, I saw James Earl Jones and Vanessa Redgrave do Driving Miss Daisy on Broadway, in a big house. Mm-hmm. When I think most people may remember Morgan Freeman and Jessica Tandy do the film. But a Broadway house with those two titans in that kind of sentimental play, dealing with the issue of, you know, sort of the slight racism that may have been bubbling up at that time, certainly, and the friction between maybe the Jews and the blacks. But that the play centers around the relationship between those two people and her son. But still, if people didn't know anything about James Earl Jones, kids, junior high school kids going to see him in that, but yet they read the program or know what he's done before, it's like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Of course, with those pipes.
Yeah.
It's hard, I would think, for him to play down. He has to be a little bit larger than life, doesn't he?
You know what's ironic? Now he has COPD. Mm-hmm. He has COPD.
That's sad to hear. I did meet him one time, and I was surprised at how shy he seemed to be.
Yeah? What's that?
Very briefly, the Library of Congress was restoring films, still is. This was, 20 years ago now, something like that. And they were in town to kind of celebrate some of the work they had done, I think, with the UW, either film department or the Historical Society. And part of that celebration was a reception with James Earl Jones. And, he was just kind of receiving people casually at this. And I just happened to talk to him. And it was, as I say, a surprise at just kind of how low-key he was compared to bigger than life.
If people don't know or recognize some of these names that Norman and I are talking about, do yourself a favor and just look the names up, read about them. If there are any young people listening to this, look up who these people are and were.
Well, Baron Kelly, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Going through some of the psychology of acting and, of course, the unusual trajectory of Earl Hyman.
Great pleasure for me. Thank you for asking me, Norman.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineers are Tom Blaine and Lee Rayburn, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Year.